The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Mr. Whitaker, thank you for your presence here today. This hearing is important because there are many Americans throughout the country who are confused. I'm confused. I really am. We're all trying to figure out, who are you, where did you come from, and how the heck did you become the head of the Department of Justice? Yes. Hopefully you can help me work through this confusion.
All right, yeah. I'm not
Mr. Whitaker, that was a statement, not a question. I assume you know the difference.
Maybe not. Maybe not. If you've been watching the hearings unfold throughout the morning, Matthew Whitaker, the acting attorney general, yes, is in the hot seat at the House Judiciary Committee after a lot of drama yesterday where, you know, first he was going to testify, but he didn't respond to some questions from the committee in a timely manner. So what they did was yesterday they authorized a they authorized the issuance of a subpoena in the event that Matthew Whitaker pulled some crap and either didn't show up or refused to answer questions. Well, Matthew Whitaker got all bent out of shape and said, well, if you're going to issue a subpoena, then I'm not going to come. And Gerald Nadler, the chair of the committee, said, well, if you show up and answer questions, there won't be any need for us to issue a subpoena. And it went round and round like that until about last night. At about 9:30, Gerald Nadler issued a statement saying that Matthew Whitaker will indeed, testify tomorrow. And so there he is. Now, if you've watched it, I don't know how much of it is actual testimony. And yes, that was the comedy bit in the opening. Sorry. it was kind of funny. The whole thing is basically a clusterfuck. I mean, it's just... there are no words. Now, I did invite our friend Marcy Wheeler of emptywheel.net to join us and sort of fill us in on what's going on. But as you know, the hearing is still happening, so that's not that's not going to happen. But I do refer you to her Twitter stream at Empty Wheel and her blog at emptywheel.net because she's live tweeting the entire thing. And Marcy Wheeler always has some great insights. Now, to back up a little bit, Democrats have called Matthew Wheeler. They're planning. The plan was to grill him most on anything they want to. It's a wide ranging hearing on with the Judiciary Committee. The main course of action was to grill him on whether he has sought to influence Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe and whether he's talked with the president about the investigation's findings. And throughout the questioning so far this morning, he really hasn't answered the questions. So what I opened with was Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of New York asking the question that continued running through my head as I watched the hearings all morning. Who the fuck are you, and how did you come to head the DOJ? And as you heard, he started stammering, and then Jeffrey said, "Not really a question; it was a statement." But here's how he continued:
The investigation into possible Trump-Russia collusion in the 2016 election has resulted in 37 indictments. Is that correct?
Answer.
I believe that number is correct, but most of those folks were Russian citizens.
So?
34 individuals have been indicted, true?
While I haven't counted those as I prepared for
during
preparation, I believe those are consistent with the numbers that as I know them.
Three corporate entities have been indicted, correct?
Correct.
I believe so, correct.
The investigation has identified 199 different criminal acts, true?
Ouch.
I haven't counted every indictment,
of course,
but that
you
sounds
haven't.
Consistent with what I understand.
There have been 7 guilty pleas, correct?
Yes.
Yes, there have been 7 guilty pleas.
4 people have already been sentenced to prison. True?
I believe so, but I do not have this information in front of me. So to the extent that, you know, I disagree with you, it's because these are facts.
Understood.
No,
thank you.
Shut up.
Trump's best friend, Roger Stone, was recently indicted for lying to Congress in connection with his possible involvement with WikiLeaks and Russian interference with the 2016 election, correct?
Yes, and I mentioned Mr. Stone's indictment and arrest.
Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, pled guilty to conspiracy to defraud the United States, true?
Mr. Manafort
Hello?
Did plead guilty, yes.
Trump's deputy campaign manager, Rick Gates, has pled guilty to lying to the FBI, correct?
Correct.
While I don't have the indictment in front of me, I have no reason to disagree with you.
Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, has pled guilty to lying to the FBI, correct?
You feel hear where this is going. Oh, my God.
Trump's longtime personal attorney and consigliere, Michael Cohen, pled guilty to lying to Congress about the Trump Real Estate Organization's Moscow project. Is that true?
I believe that was one of the bases for his plea agreement. There were several other reasons.
You can
that
hear
Mr.
him
Cohen
twisting.
Trump's campaign foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos, has pled guilty to lying to federal investigators about his contacts with Russian agents during the 2016 campaign. True?
True.
While I'm sure there are many that disagree with that title that you put on Mr. Papadopoulos, it is true that he has pled guilty, yes.
So despite all of the evidence of criminal wrongdoing that has been uncovered, do you still believe that the Mueller investigation is a lynch mob?
Ooh.
Congressman, can you tell me specifically where I said that?
Okay.
I'd be happy to. So in a tweet that you issued on August 6th of 2017, you made reference to a note to Trump's lawyer, do not cooperate with Mueller's lynch mob.
Oh, my God.
You recall that?
I recall that I said
that
I retweeted
say,
an article.
Right there. This should
that was,
disqualify
that was
titled
him. That. I did not necessarily agree with this.
Stop lying. Stop lying. And that's what I mean, and a lot of these members of Congress did basically go to that line. But, oh, my God, the way this guy is hedging, I'm just waiting for the hedge clippers to come out.
That position, but my point was that it was an interesting read for those that want to understand
bullshit.
The situation.
Okay, reclaiming my time. Manafort, Gates, Flynn, Cohen, Papadopoulos, and Stone are all in deep trouble. One by one, all of the president's men are going down in flames. It's often said where there's smoke, there's fire. There's a lot of smoke emanating from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue right now. Yet, you decided not to recuse yourself. Is that right?
Congressman, the decision to recuse was my decision to make. I looked at all of the information. I consulted with many people that I've discussed today. And I determined that it was not necessary for me to recuse.
And Donald Trump considered the Sessions recusal to be a betrayal. Is that right?
Congressman, I have no idea as I sit here today what the president believed about General Sessions' recusal.
Okay, so let's be clear. The investigation into Russia's attack on our democracy is not a witch hunt. It's not a fishing expedition. It's not a hoax. It's not a lynch mob. It's a national security imperative. The fact that people suggest otherwise comes dangerously close to providing aid and comfort to the enemy. In your final week, keep your hands off the Mueller investigation. I yield back.
All right. Hakeem Jeffries, obviously doing what a lot of these people do from these hearings, trying to make a name for himself. And, he got Whitaker to admit to all the indictments, all the guilty pleas, all the, the swamp that's enveloping Donald Trump, and basically ended his with a directive to keep your hands off the Mueller investigation. Again, I go back to the way Hakeem Jeffries started by asking, "Who are you, and how did you get here?" To answer that question, who he is, in case you didn't already know, he is wholly unqualified for that job, even that of acting attorney general. It's a front, an affront to everyone who works in the Justice Department. I mentioned Marcy Wheeler, who's doing a great job. Well, live tweeting the hearings and of course, writing about it at emptywheel.net. She refers to Whitaker. And if you follow her Twitter feed, she's calling him BDTS. And if you're wondering what does BDTS stand for, it stands for Big Dick Toilet Salesman. And she explained in a blog post why she refers to Whitaker as the Big Dick Toilet Salesman. She says, quote, "The entire point of Matt Whitaker's appointment, the only reason he's a national figure, is about Trump deliberately choosing a fraudster to lead the Department of Justice in hopes of manipulating the rule of law. Whitaker is not qualified in any normal sense of the word. He is there exclusively because he managed to pitch himself to Trump using the very same skills he used to sell wacky patents for things like, yes, big dick toilets. It's a thing. He sold them for years, a toilet for men with big dicks. Not that Matthew Whitaker would know, because from what I can tell, he has no dick at all. But that's besides the point. Back to Marcy, he shouldn't have accepted the position, but he did, so because he was selling yet another oversold novelty." And she concluded that this should always be at the forefront of discussions about Whitaker, to emphasize how illegitimate his appointment was, and so I use them. Okay, so there's the background on why Matthew Whitaker is the BDTS. So things got off to a contentious start in the opening moments of the hearing, as Whitaker was pressed by Democrats to explain his role in, you know, overseeing the Mueller investigation. Whitaker challenged committee chairman Gerald Nadler each time the chair asked Whitaker to explain what he's been told about the special counsel investigation and what he's told others. I'm not going to play the whole exchange for you because, frankly, it's pretty dry. Gerald Nadler did a great job, you know, of pushing him on these questions. And Whitaker's like, "Well, I'm not going to answer that." And then this happened.
"Now, in your capacity as acting attorney general, have you ever been asked to approve any request or action to be taken by the special counsel?"
"Mr. Chairman, I see that your 5 minutes is up, and so..."
Oh, my God. Oh, my fucking God.
I'm here voluntarily. We have agreed to five-minute rounds.
We can issue a subpoena.
The committee.
I think that's a fine place to end the five-minute rule.
And that's the Collins, committee, the ranking member, who needs to shut his fucking mouth.
Come to order. I will point out that we didn't enforce the five-minute rule on Acting Attorney General Whitaker. We will...
I understand, Mr. Chairman. I was just saying that might be a good breaking point at that.
Collins, shut up.
The Attorney General was in the middle of saying something. Answer the question, please.
Regular order.
Should I ask the question? Okay. Yeah, in your capacity,
please ask the question.
Let me just repeat the question so people remember what we're talking about. In your capacity as Acting Attorney General, have you ever been asked to approve any request or action to be taken by the special counsel?
Answer. Hello.
Mr. Chairman, I, as the acting attorney general, I am under the special counsel's rules. I am the person that is ultimately in charge of the investigation, and I have exercised that authority under the special counsel's regulations of the Department of Justice.
So I assume the answer is yes.
Regular order, Mr. Chairman.
I assume the answer is yes. You have been asked to approve a request or action, and you've said yes or no.
Mr. Chairman, I want to be very clear about what God. You're asking me. Are you asking me if I have asked the special counsel to do something?
Regular order, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Okay, and it went on from there. He knows exactly what was asked. He was just he just was refusing to answer the questions. So he dared to the chair of the Judiciary Committee asks him a question, and his response is, "I think your 5 minutes is up." You know what? I said he's got no dick, but my God, he's got a pair of balls on him. Except Sheila Jackson Lee cut him off.
Congresswoman,
can the clock be restored?
It was.
I'm sorry, what was your... I don't know if your time's been restored or not.
Okay, I want to make sure you heard what happened there. So, because I didn't have what happened before. Sheila Jackson Lee was doing her questioning. There was obviously Whitaker wouldn't answer something. The idiot Collins, ranking member from, I think, Georgia, stuck his nose in there. And so there was some break in her questioning. And so she was asking the chair, do I have more time? Obviously some of my time was taken up. Has my time been restored? And Whitaker sticks his nose in there to make a joke about her time.
Congresswoman,
can the clock be restored?
Can the time be restored?
I'm sorry, what was your... I don't know if your time's been restored or not.
No one was asking him.
Mr. Attorney General, we're not joking here. And your humor is not acceptable. Now, you are here because we have a constitutional duty to ask questions, and the Congress has the right to establish government rules. The rules are that you are here. So I need to ask the question, and I need to have my time restored so that you can behave appropriately. I will behave appropriately as a member of the Judiciary Committee.
Oh, yeah. That's the way it's done. Now, somebody who is making a name for himself in these hearings is, frankly, somebody I wasn't aware of, David Cicilline. Of Rhode Island. Here's a little bit of his questioning.
Did the president lash out at you after Michael Cohen's guilty plea for lying to Congress about a Trump Organization project to build a tower in Moscow?
Which we've heard he did.
The president specifically tweeted that he had not lashed out.
I'm asking you, Mr. Whitaker, did the president lash out at you? I'm not asking what he tweeted. I don't have a lot of confidence in the veracity of his tweets. I'm asking you under oath.
Congressman, that is based on an unsubstantiated...
Sir, answer the question, yes or no. Did the president lash out to you about Mr. Cohen's guilty plea?
No, he did not.
And did anyone from the White House or anyone on the president's behalf lash out at you?
No.
Mr. Whitaker, did the...
All right, I'm not going to play the rest of it because he's just so blatantly lied. There's this long silence and then... No. It's sort of like Donald Trump's tell. Remember on the plane when he was asked if he knew about Michael Cohen's $130,000 payoff to Susan McDougal? No. He has this very no. And that's his tell. This guy, instead of being forceful, no. No. There's another. There were so many great exchanges, and Hopefully, they will. A lot of them will be excerpted and posted all over the interwebs. Just a short while ago, Pramila Jayapal, who is now one of the co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, it was her turn for questioning. And this is a 6-minute clip. I'm not going to play the whole thing. I wish I could. Let me just give you a taste of it.
Our country is still reeling from the horrors of family separation that occurred at the border. I was the first member of Congress to talk to hundreds of women and men who had been ripped apart from their children. I went into a federal prison to talk to those women. Many of them had not even been able to say goodbye to their children. They sat in the room next door as they heard their children yelling for them, and they were not able to go and speak to their children. And for weeks, they didn't know where their children were. Most of these women, most of the men, were seeking asylum. And your department, instead of allowing them their legal right to seek asylum, your department instead imposed a zero humanity policy to prosecute them in mass proceedings, resulting in the U.S. government tearing thousands of children from their moms and dads. And this is still happening. And the truth is, we may not know how many children were separated from their parents.
Sickening.
So, Mr. Whitaker, you were former Attorney General Jeff Sessions' chief of staff at the time. Is that correct?
Of the zero tolerance policy being implemented?
You were his chief of staff at the time.
At what point in time? I was
of the family separation policy. Let me just tell you,
I'm sorry, there was no family separation policy.
there was a
tolerance policy.
This has been given four Pinocchios multiple times.
Thank you.
I'm just going to tell you, you were former Attorney General's chief of staff at the time. Last month, Senator Merkley released a leaked draft memo by senior officials at the Department of Justice and Homeland Security outlining policies to separate children from their families. Were you aware of this memo at the time?
No.
Sure.
So as the chief of staff, you were not aware of what your boss was doing?
Was the memo, I'm sorry, was you're talking about the leaked memo or the memo that General Sessions issued?
There was a leaked draft memo by senior officials at the Department of Justice. You were the chief of staff. I would think you would know, and you would be a senior official, you would know about that memo. The memo stated that a policy of criminally prosecuting parents would require close coordination between DHS and the Department of Health and Human Services, which would be tasked with housing children separated from their moms and dads. And yet a report released by the Government Accountability Office last October says that DHS and HHS were, quote, unaware that your boss, former boss's zero tolerance prosecution policy memo was coming. Is it correct that the Department of Justice provided no advance notice to those departments?
Congresswoman, the department's
just a yes or no. did you provide advance notice to those
departments? Press conference in San Diego with the head of the Immigration Customs Enforcement when we announced the zero tolerance policy. And all the zero tolerance policy does is says that we will take all referrals from DHS.
I'm just going to stop you right there because it is my time. According to
you, all right. We went halfway through it. It goes on like that. He denies it. She presses him on it. She's great. Pramila Jayapal. One to watch. She's awesome. So that's going on right now. It's going on all day. It'll continue probably, hopefully, for another long while through in the afternoon, making him really uncomfortable. By the way, he's drank a whole lot of water. He looks very uncomfortable up there. And that's good. But there's other news going on, too. So let's get on with it. The sad news, former Congressman John Dingell died last night. He's the longest serving member ever in Congress. He arrived in Congress in 1955 to fill a seat that was held by his father, John Dingell Sr., and continued to serve for more than 59 years until he announced his retirement in 2014. Dingell played a key role in passing the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, the Clean Water Act, and Obamacare. And he had a hilarious Twitter feed, and it's still up, and you should check it out, just at John Dingell. D-I-N-G-E-L-L. In fact, he did a fundraiser. You know, it was the congressman from Michigan, and he did a fundraiser for the Eclecta blog in which he sat and read some of his tweets in front of a live audience. Unfortunately, the audio is not really good, or I play it for you. But he was one of the great ones, and what a loss. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff hired for his investigations at least one former White House aide who served under President Obama and then remained beyond the transition to help the Trump administration. Reports identify this new hire as Abigail Grace, yes, an Obama-era holdover, and former member of Trump's National Security Council. News of the chairman's move dramatically escalated tensions with the president, is how one newspaper put it. Yeah, Trump's fuming. He tweeted, "The Dems and their committees are going nuts. The Republicans never did this to President Obama." No, they just did a whole lot worse. He goes on and calls it a continuation of a witch hunt. By the way, Schiff replied by saying, "We have a long tradition of hiring out of the intelligence community, the National Security Council, and if the president is worried about our hiring any former administration people, maybe he should work on being a better employer." Well said. By the way, speaking of the attorney general, Trump's nominee to become the next attorney general, William Barr, was voted out of the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday and will be considered by the Republican-controlled Senate sometime later this month, unfortunately. The strangest story of the day, week, month, I would say year, but we're dealing with Donald Trump. So let's just say one of the strangest stories in a long time involves Amazon founder and world's richest man, Jeff Bezos. Yesterday, Bezos posted a missive on Medium which I sat in a doctor's office waiting room reading with my jaw dropping, and to the point where somebody walked into the office and I jumped because I was so startled. I was so shocked by what I was reading. In this Medium post, which I'll link from the blog today at NicoleSandler.com, Bezos claims that AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, tried to blackmail him. Bezos said AMI threatened to publish compromising pictures of him and a woman the tabloid said Bezos was having an affair with. This after reporting on the affair and publishing private texts between the two last month. Bezos said the Enquirer was upset that he had used his private security consultant to investigate the tabloid to find out how it got those texts. His Medium posts contain emails that Bezos says backs up his claims.
Jeff Bezos released emails yesterday claiming to show the company, AMI, threatened to release the information if he did not stop an investigation into how the Enquirer got the text messages that included explicit photos exposing his extramarital affair. NBC News has not independently reviewed the emails. To keep the information from getting out, Bezos says that AMI demanded he stop the Washington Post, which he owns, from reporting on the political motivations behind the Enquirer's initial reports about his relationship with Lauren Sanchez. In a letter posted on the blogging site Medium, Bezos writes in part this: "If in my position, I cannot stand up to this type of extortion, how many people can? Of course, I don't want personal photos published, but I also won't participate in their well-known practice of blackmail."
Good for him. I mean, Jeff Bezos, love him or hate him, you got to applaud him for standing up to this shit. I mean, he could easily afford to pay them off and wouldn't even miss it. But he's like, no, hell no. NBC's Dylan Byers points out one aspect of Bezos' accusations that I think are going to resonate and have further implications.
For me, the most interesting aspect of what Jeff Bezos wrote in that post is the insinuation, not the direct allegation, but just the insinuation that there's a political motivation here that is driven either by President Trump, who has a longstanding relationship with David Pecker, or by Saudi Arabia, which also has ties to David Pecker.
Huh.
There's an insinuation there from Bezos of a political motivation, and I think that is the thread that's going to be pulled out over the course of the next few days and weeks.
Now, it may be redundant, but one thing we've learned is David Pecker, what a dick. Anyway, the Associated Press is reporting that federal prosecutors are now probing whether National Enquirer's handling of the Bezos story violated their cooperation deal. Under the terms of the deal, it's off if they break the law. Well, I think they broke the law. So we may be seeing the beginning of the end of the National Enquirer. Wouldn't that be a lovely thing? The Supreme Court is stopping Louisiana from enforcing new regulations on abortion clinics in a test of the conservative court's views on abortion rights. Chief Justice John Roberts yesterday joined with the court's liberals to rule 5-4 against a law that requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, would close most of the state's clinics, and leave it with only one doctor eligible to perform the procedure. Now, Brett Kavanaugh, you remember him, wrote a ridiculous dissent that none of the other justices even signed on to, prompting critics to lash out at Senator Susan Collins over her pre-confirmation assertions that Kavanaugh would uphold precedent and wouldn't repeal Roe v. Wade. Yeah, right. He just proved the opposite yesterday, though we did get a bit of a reprieve. A Trump reality TV show that is his administration is doing it again. This time, a former Fox News reporter, Leah Gabriel, told Foreign Policy magazine that she expects to be appointed to lead the Global Engagement Center. That's a State Department group charged with countering foreign propaganda and disinformation. I couldn't make this shit up if I tried. What else? The shutdown is still, you know, a week away. Supposedly, there's a bipartisan group getting together at Camp David this weekend. We'll see what happens. I don't think there's going to be another shutdown, despite Donald Trump's, worst efforts. I don't know what's on his mind. And finally, freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez yesterday, along with Senator Ed Markey on the Senate side, officially introduced the Green New Deal resolution.
I am so incredibly excited that we are going to transition this country into the future.
The transition Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is talking about is her first piece of legislation, a non-binding resolution, the Green New Deal. It goes beyond climate change, way beyond.
Today is the day that we truly embark on a comprehensive agenda of economic, social, and racial justice in the United States of America.
That's right.
Surrounded by House and Senate veterans, the freshman Democrat from New York took center stage.
You guys expect this to be offset by higher taxes?
So, do you want me?
You go. Yeah, please.
The same resolution being introduced in the Senate by Ed Markey from Massachusetts, elected to Congress 13 years before Ocasio-Cortez was born.
We now have the troops. We now have the money. We're ready to fight.
The resolution, just 14 pages long, by some estimates could cost trillions, calls for a revolution in the way we live. Viewing climate change as an existential threat to the entire world. Fire, drought, rising sea levels, increasingly violent storms, famine, and mass migrations is what we face, they warn, if radical change isn't embraced now.
We're here to say that small, incremental policy solutions are not enough.
The Green New Deal calls for a 10-year national mobilization. The goal in one short decade to bring greenhouse gas emissions to zero, meet 100% of energy needs by renewable sources, overhaul transportation systems, create millions of high-paying jobs, bring equality in health care and equal justice for underserved, minority, and impoverished communities.
We should be open to the fact that wealth transfer schemes suggested in the radical policies like the Green New Deal may not be the best path to community prosperity.
Other Republicans said the plan sounded more like communist economic doctrine. House Speaker Democrat Nancy Pelosi first seemed to throw cold water on the idea, calling it the Green Dream while talking to Politico. Then she changed her tune.
I welcome the Green New Deal and any other proposals that people have out there.
The Green New Deal could divide progressive and centrist Democrats. 2020 hopefuls Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and Kirsten Gillibrand support the resolution.
We'll see what goes on. Yes, Nancy Pelosi stepped back a little bit from her absurd criticism. It's a green dream. No one really knows what it is, but they support it, right? Ugh. Ugh. Oh, well. We're going to move on. Apparently, the hearing is over. Matt Whitaker picked up his papers and, I guess, all his water bottles and left the hearing room. I'm sure we haven't heard the last from what went down today. All right. You know, this has been a hell of a week, right? It's Friday, thank God. But do you realize that the State of the Union address was Tuesday? That was this week. All the kerfuffle over the response. Yes, Stacey Abrams was tapped to deliver the official response. But, of course, conservadem Twitter went ballistic when Bernie Sanders said that for the third year in a row, he's going to respond himself to the State of the Union address and do it on his social media feed to comment on what happened on Tuesday in all these realms. Our old pal Harvey J.K. joins us.
Well, where is he?
Where is who?
Where is Harvey?
Oh, you mean Harvey J.K.
Yeah, Harvey.
Well, he's coming up right now on the Nicole Sandler Show.
I love that intro, though it doesn't really tell us much about who Harvey is.
I love that intro, too.
Professor of democracy and justice at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay, and the author of a few books, including The Fight for the Four Freedoms and Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Harvey J.K., always wonderful to have you on the show. What a week this has been, huh?
Well, thank you for your patience till Friday and having me come on, because I would have loved to have come on the morning after.
I know. And we were going to have you on the morning after, just your teaching schedule got in the way. And I said, that's okay. Oh, we can do it on Friday because, you know, hey, we're loose around here.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that I spent the entire day Wednesday with my students talking about the State of the Union. They had to watch the night before. I gave them some heads up as to what to look for, but they found even more than I did to talk about. So it was a full day, and And we can start with just the reference that you made to Bernie Sanders' response.
Uh-huh.
which we should definitely get to. Obviously, we have time.
Yep.
Bernie, you know, I had briefly forgotten that he was going to respond in spite of all the kerfuffle about his desire to do so.
Oh, all you had to do was come into my Twitter stream. You couldn't have missed it.
Which is what I should have done. And then I caught up late and I backed it up and I listened. And it was even more powerful than I expected. Let's say that and leave mm-hmm. that for a little later. How's
okay.
that?
Okay. Well, one thing, let me say, what Bernie Sanders delivered was actually a response to the State of the Union address. He picked
right.
it apart point by point. And for people who were, you know, criticizing him, oh, Bernie was editing his speech during Trump's State of the Union. He was taking notes. He was writing his speech to respond to the massive load of bullshit we were being fed by Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was clearly, you know, I'll just start regarding the State of the Union address itself. I'll start with what I told my students, and don't take this the wrong way, was an actually brilliant element of the speech.
Well, okay. What was that?
Okay. Now, the brilliant element of the speech, because of the folks who are listening or watching at home,
mm-hmm.
is that they set up the entire speech so that he would say something that anyone and everyone could and would have to applaud.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And they would drive it home, and they would, to the point where even the Democrats had to applaud, or they would be seen as somehow opposing fighting childhood cancer,
right.
or opposing family leave.
Yep.
And so there they would be in the midst of their applause, and then maybe the entire Capitol Dome was still reverberating from that applause, and then he shifted, and I haven't in particular when he did talk about combating childhood cancer and the young girl, the 10-year-old girl who was up in the gallery, mm-hmm. and then the family leave reference, and then all of a sudden, bam, it's the right to choose. It's the abortion question.
It's the infanticide, and they're killing newborn babies, and oh my
right.
God.
Right, that's right. And you can almost imagine that even the Dems, who might have been mid-applause, all of a sudden somehow had to suck back in
yep.
that applause. I mean, so that people, you know, obviously are still thinking about the applause lines. But then he blew the brilliance. It was really great. So we were watching. All of a sudden, without going on, he shifts again to military questions, mm-hmm. to national security questions.
Oh, it was so disjointed.
His whole position.
Yes. It was so disjointed. It was like this thing, and then out of left field, that one, and all over the place. And while you brought up the childhood cancer thing, let me just say, $500 million? I'm sorry. Now, to someone who's broke,
right,
that's a lot of money.
Right.
But that's a drop in the bucket. It's nothing. He's basically saying, yeah, we'll throw him a pittance.
Right. And am I mistaken in saying one of my students said that he referred to that as a 10-year $500 million.
Oh, my God.
You know, so
here's 50 bucks. Go cure cancer.
Yeah, right. It's, you know, but, you know, for most Americans, the words $500 million are still, even with
like
the billions thrown around, are striking.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, it wasn't too long after that where we really had further testimony to how much of a madman he actually is. And I don't know if you're guessing already what I'm about to refer to, but if he were not elected, we would be in a new war in East Asia.
Oh, my God. If I had not been elected president of the United States, I believe right now we'd be in a major war with North Korea. Oh, my God.
Really. Yeah. At that point, I said, oh, my God, he really is a madman. There's just no question. And of course, you know, all of his remarks always have to do with him. So, of course, that was his doing that. But as I said, there were times in which he really had set it up properly to take the Democrats down. Now, I'm going to bring up something which may come across as a little surprising and controversial.
Okay.
But it had to do with his reference to the fact that, never before have so many women been involved in the workplace.
Yeah,
I've got the
clip right here. Let's play it.
Okay,
here
play
we go.
That because I'd
no
like to address that.
Here we go.
No one has benefited more from our thriving economy than women, who have filled 58% of the newly created jobs last year.
And then the women start saying, that's us.
You weren't supposed to do that.
You weren't supposed to do that.
Thank you very much.
And then he
thanks them.
Because he's such
Well, let me sound a little contrarian on this, okay?
Yep.
Because when I heard him say that, I thought of this. Now, this takes us back in time a bit. So when I was working on my book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, I actually began before the Great Depression and the struggles in the New Deal back in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Economic historians and historians, they always talk about the fact that this was a time of economic growth and technological advances, that this was, that household income was never as high before that as ever. Basically, they ignore the degree to which this was one of the high moments of what was known as the Gilded Age and inequality. But the key thing is this. If household income went up, it's not necessarily a sign that working people are doing well. I know that sounds contradictory. But what it means is that more and more of the members of the household have to go out to work, possibly at low-wage jobs. But when totaled, they come up to a higher household income. Well, when he says, you know, 58% or whatever number of the jobs were filled by women, my mind went to the fact that it has been years and years since the jobs that are being created in this highly regulated corporate economy are really good jobs. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that a lot of those women, I can't vouch for any one of their reasons for doing so, but a lot of those women may not have wanted to go out and fill what might well have been minimum wage jobs, which, by the way, are punishing low wage jobs.
Yep.
So this, to me, the giddiness, and I actually sat there, and it sounds contrary, and I said, oh, don't get up and applaud at that point. Don't do it, because it's all well and good for women who have just been elected to Congress.
Right.
And God, it's wonderful they were. But it's all well and good for them to celebrate that fact. But it may well be the case that a hell of a lot of women at home said, well, screw this. I didn't want to go work in Kmart, or I didn't want to go work in a McDonald's.
And I get, but look, I'm right in there. Believe me, I'm one of those women. But the thing is, what happened there is those women all realized that they filled all these openings and a lot of men who were voted out of Congress, and they replaced them. And it was just a moment of, I think, a big giant fuck you to Donald Trump. And I thought it was beautiful.
Right. Yep. Right. And my immediate reaction was, you're getting too giddy now. Stop. Don't give him.
But I love that he's like, you weren't supposed to do that. He didn't know how to react to it. And then he says, thank you.
Well, one of my students said in every class, at least one student said, that was the only time he looked at the Democratic side of the room.
Sure. And he didn't know what to make
to
of it.
Look at the women in white, right?
Nope.
He just couldn't bear to look at the women dressed as suffragists.
Right.
It was really magnificent. Now, you know, having said that, there was other things that just really struck me, and I can't help but notice them.
Okay.
I don't want to go on too long about him, but his effort, as my students noted, his effort to portray himself as the defender of the working class once again.
Yep.
Okay, where this whole wall idea basically was him acting on behalf of the working class to defend the working class against not only all of those, undocumented, but all those illegal aliens who were about to invade the country, but also against all of those rich people. Remember, he said that basically those people in their walled gated communities,
they don't
suffer what you guys suffer. They don't realize. He was sort of the guy it's astonishing here. Here's the guy who hires undocumented workers and has done so for years and years.
Yep.
Pretending to be the champion, right?
Yeah.
The champion of working people. That one I thought was just, talk about audacity and what's it called? Hypocrisy.
Yep.
My goodness, right?
Yep.
Let's see if there before I go on to other things. Well, I mean, you know, he was a typical Republican. I mean, let's not make him too special or unique. A very typical Republican. He made every effort to somehow link himself, as Reagan did, bizarrely, with the Greatest Generation. Right.
Right.
He had the Holocaust survivors, and he had the survivors of Normandy and similar kinds of struggles of World War II.
Yep.
But what's fascinating is, and this is the thing that this was actually one of the things that motivated me to write over the past 20 years. It's that these Republicans make every effort to lay claim to the legacy of the Greatest Generation. What they do is they narrow the idea of the great of that experience to the combat, to the war, which itself warrants celebration. But what they do is, even as they do that, they turn around and they make war on the legacy of the Greatest Generation.
Sure.
Social Security, yep. National Labor yep. Relations Act, Medicare, Medicaid, the opening of the borders to regulated immigration. You know, the 1965, the Immigration Act, which lifted the Immigration Quota Act of 1924. The EPA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Consumer Product Safety Board, they make war on civil rights, on voting rights. And these are all, if you like, part of the legacy of the 30s, the 40s, and the 60s that was the Greatest Generation. And it just, in that sense, is just like the rest of them. And they should all not only be ashamed of themselves, but as soon as possible, driven from office.
Without a doubt. Yeah, Donald Trump, I mean, he's a gaslighter. He says one thing when, you know, he just lies. This whole speech was just such a giant clusterfuck.
Yes.
I mean, it was just
absolutely
horrible.
Which brings us to the Democratic response, I guess, right?
Uh-huh.
And I let me make clear before I say anything that I have met and I think of myself as a somewhat of a friend of Stacey Abrams. I think she's a marvelous politician. I think she's got great possibilities. The Georgia gubernatorial election was stolen by, you know, voter suppression.
Oh,
and
absolutely. And I said when I was talking about her delivering the response to the State of the Union, she is the woman who, if not for voter suppression and the other tactics in Georgia, would be governor of Georgia right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And listening to her, I mean, she did a marvelous job. There's no question. It wasn't powerful. But she hit some really good points, and I think she actually made friends as a consequence. However, there was one point in her speech where I wanted to, like, I wished I had some kind of thing in her ear.
And maybe I've got the clip. Let me play it, and then you can explain what your problem was with it. Here we go.
Even as I am very disappointed by the president's approach to our problems, I still don't want him to fail. But we need him to tell the truth and to respect his duties and respect the extraordinary diversity that defines America.
Yeah, I mean, I have no argument with the last phrases of what she said.
You need him to tell the truth. I don't think he's capable.
But I can tell you, there isn't a chance in hell that anyone on the left or in their right mind would want Donald Trump to succeed. And I mean, the man is a danger to America.
Mm-hmm.
The man's ambitions are to subvert democracy, to turn us basically, as one of the podcasters that I listen to says, it's basically to sell off America for spare parts, you know? I mean, this guy is out to destroy us, and the
yep.
Republicans go right along
yep.
with it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so who stuck that in? I don't want to fail. And it reminded me of an exchange
because that's the adult Democratic thing to say. Of course, I want him to succeed, but I don't want him to succeed at the policies he's putting forth. You know,
yeah, I'd want him to fall flat on his
exactly.
face and take Pence with him.
Now,
exactly. This reminds me, if you don't mind my mentioning, an exchange I had. I had an exchange on Twitter sometime this past year. Everything goes by. So fast, I can't remember when and where it occurred,
right.
But I had this exchange with Jake Tapper of CNN.
Okay. Yeah.
And there are moments where Tapper shines, and there are moments where he's just utterly abysmal.
Yep.
And this one particular day, he actually made this statement. He said, I believe that Donald Trump loves America, and I practically vomited.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, he's got to be kidding. So I tweeted, and I said, you know, how dare you, you know, and he came back and he basically said, I had to withdraw what I said because I must have accused him of something like, you know, pandering or who the hell knows what. And I thought to myself, bullshit, nobody can tell me Donald Trump loves America. I mean, you know, even if it turns out that he hasn't exactly been the poodle for Putin, the fact is that everything he's done basically serves the interests of those who would like to tear down this country. It's
right.
just a stop.
Well, it's all about,
you know,
Donald Trump. He's Trump first. He's not America first. He's not anyone else first. All he cares about is himself. And for those people saying, you know, maybe when Don Jr. is indicted, he doesn't care. I think he'll throw his kids under the bus as long as he's okay.
Yeah. And by the way, I was listening to some of the taping ahead of the hearings for Whitaker today. I mean, some of these Democratic congressional folks, where have they been? Right. I mean, all of a sudden they were ready to go for the jugular in some cases.
Yeah.
And it was such a pleasure to hear Democrats
back.
Sounding like Democrats ought to sound, you know.
Well, they just got the power. So good for them.
Yeah, right. Which then, of course, brings us to the highlight of the night, though most Americans didn't know to tune in because, you know, it wasn't on TV.
Right.
But Bernie Sanders' response, okay? I mean, it was clearly, as you just said a little while ago, it really was a response to the State of the Union by Trump.
Yeah. Now, can I just say, I thought Stacey Abrams was very good. She's a great speaker.
Well, I said,
I think she's inspiring. There's something really compelling about her. She's relatable. But her speech had nothing to do with the State of the Union. It was the official response.
Right.
But it was Stacey Abrams telling her story, introducing herself to the Democratic audience out there.
Right. That's right.
You know, put in that position by the party who wants to see her run for governor or for Senate against David Perdue in 2020. This was Stacey Abrams, with the Democrats' blessing, launching her national political career. It was not responding to the State of the Union address. For whatever that's my analysis of it. Bernie Sanders responded to the State of the Union address.
Right. By the way, and I forgot to mention, Nicole, maybe you already have it. Do you have these lines of his where it says, yes, the economy is great for the three wealthiest people in America? Do you have that little section? Otherwise I would read it. But if you could hit that, it would be great for people just to hear his take on that.
Wait, you're talking about Bernie's?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Bernie's thing. I'm sorry. It was the lines. Here's the lines. And stop me if you have them and want to play Bernie's voice. Yes, the economy is great for the three wealthiest people in America who own more wealth than the bottom half of our country, 160 million people. Yes, the economy is great for the top 1% who now earn 46% of all new income. Yes, the economy is great for the top 25 hedge fund managers on Wall Street. Dot, 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 dot. I mean, yes. In other words, it was great. So he grabs hold of Trump's words. And what he shows is the degree to which, basically speaking, we have experienced a class war in America for the past 40 years.
Absolutely.
And that 1% of Americans, they have gotten enriched by working people's income, by working people's labors, which, by the way, as a sidebar, you know, you almost want to smack Howard Schultz. You'd think a guy like him would have known better.
Oh, my God. And can I just say, CNN? What the fuck?
He did
an event the other day and there were 20 people there. This warrants a CNN town hall?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking to myself. And what is this? You know, at one point I actually had a certain I thought Howard Schultz is a decent guy. He wants his workers to have health insurance. He wants these things. And then he turns around and says the nation can't afford this.
Yep.
Well, I guess he went and talked to his banker and realized how many billions he actually had, right?
Right.
So,
But he doesn't want you to call him a billionaire. He's a person of means, Harvey. A person of means.
He's a mean son of a bitch is what he is.
Right.
Okay.
And he's not going to be president.
I don't know if SOB
that.
Is a politically appropriate way to talk, but there you go.
Fuck
okay.
it. Okay. Who cares?
Okay. Well, now let's go to that line that I did ask you to get ready, okay?
That I've got for you. Okay.
Okay.
So this is Bernie from the response. Here we go.
President Trump said tonight, quote, "We are born free and we will stay free," end of quote. Well, I say to President Trump, people are not truly free when they can't afford to go to the doctor when they are sick. People are not truly free when they cannot afford to buy the prescription drugs they desperately need. People are not truly free when they are unable to retire with dignity. People are not truly free when they are exhausted because they are working longer and longer hours for lower wages. People are not truly free when they cannot afford a decent place in which to live. People certainly are not free when they cannot afford to feed their families. As Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1968, and I quote, "This country has socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the poor," end quote. What Dr. King said then was true, and it is true today, and it remains absolutely unacceptable.
Bernie Sanders.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Now, you will recall from these past few years that that as much as I voted for Bernie and embraced his arguments and all that, that I had a particular criticism, not only of Hillary, but also of him. And that is, the criticism is that Bernie did not make enough of the American progressive tradition, American story. And he did on one occasion back in the October, November of 2015 in the primary season, he did grab hold of FDR's Second Bill of Rights speech. He did talk about LBJ and the Great Society, mm-hmm. and he did talk about Martin Luther King as a democratic socialist. But he didn't do enough of that, and I thought it was important for him to cultivate Americans' historical memory and imagination. But in that speech, although he clearly is talking Dr. King, but he also echoed, in a absolutely beautifully echoed, Franklin Roosevelt in January 1944, when Roosevelt was about to pronounce his vision of a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights for all Americans, to make the vision and the promise of the Four Freedoms all the more meaningful in daily life. Roosevelt said, "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that the true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence." And then he said, "Necessitous men are not free men." And what Bernie did there in that paragraph was grab hold of the spirit of FDR and lay it out for us today. I just loved it. I just went crazy when I heard it.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, what scares me, and I've said this before, I don't know who I'm voting for this time out. We're still a year away from the Iowa caucuses. It's
right.
Too early. I love primary season because that's when everyone gets to put forth these great ideas and we get to imagine the possible. You know, you get to think, wow. Medicare for all, you know, a tuition-free
right.
college, a living wage, universal basic income. I mean, all these ideas. And are they all going to fly? No, but this is the time to put them out and to dream
right.
and to fall in love and to say, yes, this is possible. I'm going to work for that ideal. But what I'm seeing is a whole lot of sniping and backstabbing and ugliness
already,
and
yeah.
the attacks. My God, when I dared to mention on social media and on Twitter that Bernie was going to do his response again, the attacks were unbelievable. And then I dared to tweet out something about, I wonder, after Kamala Harris announced she's going to do her pre-buttal, I asked, I wonder what the Bernie haters think about this. And then I got attacked for calling them haters, even though they clearly hate
mm-hmm.
him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it hasn't died down yet. I mean, it's really, really sickening. And I've blocked more so-called Democrats in the last week than you know, asshole Trump.
Oh, no kidding.
Trumpers.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
I didn't do this. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Holy cow. You know, the attacks, right now there are these attacks underway against AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yep.
And one gets the feeling it's all a warm-up for what they'd like to do to Bernie.
Of course.
But it would be really great if this is to assume these are all really Democrats and not necessarily
other
folks.
Well, some of them I are. Some of them are people I know.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
No, that's a very bad sign.
It's the old Hillary-Bernie divide again. And to them, I say, get the fuck over it. I was a big Bernie supporter. In the general, I voted for Hillary Clinton. And it doesn't matter how many times I stated the fact that in 2016, more Bernie Sanders supporters voted for Hillary Clinton than Hillary Clinton supporters voted for Barack Obama in 2008. It's a fact. Mm-hmm. Look it up.
Interesting.
And
that
none
is
of the,
an
and these people
thing.
Were like, fake news. Like, get over yourself.
No, that's very interesting. I hadn't realized that.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
There's even efforts, by the way, and I won't detail them because these are people.
Yeah, we got about a minute left too. So.
They're trying to drive a wedge between Bernie and AOC as well.
Yes, they are.
So, okay. Well, this has been great.
It's always a pleasure. So overall, what did your students think about the speech and the responses? Is there a consensus? I mean, are they on the right side of history?
There definitely was. Now, let me make clear. I always used to find that in classes of mine, I would always have Trump supporters these last couple of years.
Uh-huh.
But it turned out this time that I think students, you know, the 18 to 25 year olds, they seem to have had it. I'm using my hand to indicate up to here, okay?
Right.
And I think they've had it up to here. And I think they're really looking for some action, okay? Real action. Whether it turns out to be Bernie or Sherrod Brown, who another guy I like a lot, we don't know. But I think they're looking for action.
Good. Well, I hope so. But you know what? Don't badmouth the other ones. Tell us what's great about the people you like. And let it play out, you know, in the primary season.
You bet.
Harvey J.K., find him on the Twitters at Harvey J.K. And here whenever he can join us. Thank you so much, Harvey.
I'm sure it'll be soon. I am confident.
Great.
Okay,
you take bye-bye. Care. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. If you're in South Florida, tomorrow, Saturday, 10 a.m., I'm going to be speaking at the Deerfield Beach Progressive Forum talking about the state of media today. Oh, it should be a load of fun. So if you're in South Florida, come on out and join us. Otherwise, have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you back here on Tuesday. Bye.